Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We are the 99%. You've heard that, right? Yeah, well, you know what? They've got a point. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, combining email marketing and social media for more customers and more time back on the clock. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It's the 26th of October today. And here's some fodder for the zeitgeist debate that's going on out there over whether or not Occupy Wall Street might be onto something. There's a new report out from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office on income inequality. And contained within it is a somewhat startling statistic. The top 1% of the population, the CBO says, has seen its share of total national income nearly double in the past 30 years. The CBO says the top 1% now captures more than 20% of everything we collectively take home. The protesters down on Wall Street and across the country and the world have a saying you might have heard. We are the 99%, it goes. So who's in that 1%, and what do they do for a living that gets them there? We asked Marketplace's David Gurr to find out.
So there's this old story about F. Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway, and it may be apocryphal, but supposedly Fitzgerald said to Hemingway, "The very rich are different from you and me."
And Ernest Hemingway replied, "Yes, they have a lot more money."
That's Jacob Hacker. He teaches at Yale, political science, not American literature. Anyway, Hacker says that over the last 30 years, the wealthiest Americans have gotten way wealthier.
The top 1% has pulled dramatically away from the rest of Americans over the last generation.
Hacker says government policies helped fuel that trend with tax cuts and loopholes that benefit the rich. We're talking about corporate lawyers, hedge fund managers, and real estate titans. Lane Kenworthy is a sociologist at the University of Arizona.
A third of them, roughly speaking, are executives and supervisors who are not in finance.
Kenworthy says you'd expect the top 1% to include athletes and movie stars. Well, you'd be surprised.
Sports and media is actually much, much smaller than most people imagine.
Only about 2% of that top 1%. So what's changed? Jacob Hacker says we've seen a big shift. Today's rich, for the most part, are the working rich.
Unlike the rich of the Gilded Age back in the early 20th century, the very rich today are not living off their accumulated wealth.
Making money off investments and real estate. Today, they're getting big paychecks. Those have ballooned since financial deregulation. But compensation is more than that. It's also stock options, insurance, and big bonuses. And the Gilded Age has given way to golden parachutes executives can deploy even when companies don't do so well. In Washington, I'm David Gurra for Marketplace.
In his latest attempt to get something going on the economy, President Obama announced a plan today to lower student loan payments, to basically reduce the maximum possible payments, and essentially forgive remaining debt after 20 years instead of 25, as it is now. An admittedly unscientific Marketplace in-house survey after our news meeting this morning made it clear there are a lot of people still paying down their college or graduate school years after they got out of school. So we called around to get some other perspectives.
My name's Colin Malone. I'm from Portland, Maine. My monthly payment comes to right around $620 a month. It's a substantial amount, I mean, especially when you're taking into account of rent and just cost of living. You know, it definitely holds me back in some areas where, you know, I'm renting an apartment right now with roommates. I don't drive a brand new car, you know, as far as savings goes. That's been a tough thing the last couple of years for sure.
I'm Betsy Harvey, and I'm from New Brunswick, New Jersey. I have about $35,000 worth of loans, and I expect to start paying the loans off about 6 months after I graduate, so that would be October or November 2012. I would estimate I have to pay about $300 a month. $300 a month is pretty significant, I think, especially for a starting salary.
I'm Clifford Edwards from Houston, Texas. I'm 52. I do have student loans. Including interest, my balance is up to $93,000. I don't ever see me being able to pay that off. I mean, that's more than a house costs. It's devastating. It's like this huge guillotine hanging over my head. You know, I haven't had a car in over a decade.
On Wall Street today, good news about Europe. You know how it goes from here. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Wall Street woke up to a shocker today involving one Rajat Gupta. Who, you ask? Well, it's a fair question. He's just a guy who used to head McKinsey, the big consulting firm, and who used to sit on the board of directors at Goldman Sachs, and who, as of today, is also allegedly the insider's insider. Gupta was indicted this morning for feeding trading tips to Raj Rajaratnam, the hedge fund guy, who was recently and notably convicted for insider trading. So how big a deal? Well, quite a big deal, says John Coffey from Columbia Law School.
Oh, I think it's quite significant. This is the person who really is a representative of corporate America, who, in the view of many, was the most culpable actor in this entire drama.
White-collar criminal defense attorney Solomon Weisenberg sees it a little bit differently.
The government had tons of witnesses in the Rajaratnam case. They don't have that here. What it looks like they have is some circumstantial evidence. They've also got a person who is extremely highly regarded as a defendant.
Six counts, by the way. Bail was set at $10 million, secured today by a house that Gupta owns out in Connecticut. Monsoon rains have been pounding Thailand for a good couple of months now, since July, and now the capital of Bangkok is being threatened. So rising waters are being diverted to neighboring floodplains, which, as it happens, is where a lot of the industrial parks that supply the world with everything from high-tech auto parts to components for cameras and computers happen to be located. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has that story.
The world's leading makers of computer hard drives are grouped together in Thailand's industrial parks. The tech firms say it makes sense to squeeze out cost efficiencies by concentrating their production. Steve Shattuck speaks for hard drive maker Western Digital.
We can leverage the skills of a local workforce when industries like ours are clustered together. Many of our suppliers are in the same area. That enables us a lot of benefits. Local governments also encourage that.
At Pipeline Data, analyst Mark Gomes says these firms have put themselves at risk because of tough times.
This kind of speaks to the lengths corporations have gone to keep profits rising in a subpar economic environment. You cut down tremendously on logistical costs. Problem is that it exposes you to an event such as this.
He's talking about the floodwaters now swamping the sites Thailand chose for its explosive industrial growth.
The problem is that with all the asphalt and concrete that's been laid across the entire country, there's now a lot less drainage area for the water.
Gomes says one of the biggest problems is the tiny motors and other components to make the computer drives are produced mainly in Thailand. And that's got even Apple's new CEO Tim Cook bracing for trouble. He spoke to analysts in a conference call.
It is something that I'm concerned about. I'm virtually certain there will be an overall industry shortage of disk drives as a result of the disaster. How it affects Apple, I'm not sure.
Analysts fear it could cause a chain reaction affecting everyone from chip makers to PC builders and even car companies. And they say the effects could linger well into next year. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Every time you Google something or check your Facebook or send a tweet, you're using energy. A lot of us, I'm not naming any names here, but they do those things pretty much all day long, which prompted some research into how much energy the internet actually uses. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
It takes a lot of energy to send an email. You've got to have your laptop charged, then there's the router and the cable modem, and then the data centers that the message will pass through. Dennis Szymanski is with the Electric Power Research Institute.
All of those data centers have servers and storage arrays and routers and switches that all have power cords.
And then your friend needs power to read the message. And even then, you're not done accounting for the energy it takes to make this little want-to-meet-up-for-dinner message happen.
It takes energy to make the devices in the first place.
That's Justin Ma, a postdoc at UC Berkeley. He and his research partner, Bharath Raghavan, estimated the total energy required to construct and run the internet. They included the energy it takes to make and run all the desktops and laptops and servers and smartphones, and found that 1 to 2% of all the energy used in the world goes to making the internet happen. Which is a lot. But a little perspective, all the cars and trucks and planes and trains we use, that's right around 27%. One surprise from Ma and Raghavan's research, just how much energy goes into making the devices.
It turns out that manufacturing energy is roughly half of the internet's total energy use.
Sure, there's value in trying to make data centers more efficient and unplugging our computers. But, says Ma, the really big energy savings might come from holding on to our computers and smartphones just a little or a lot longer. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
We'd give you the latest on the European debt crisis right now, except in all honesty, there's no real news. They're still talking about it. But that in and of itself is worth a mention because it's tough to talk to people that you don't necessarily like. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is on the line from London to explain what I'm talking about. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
So we talked earlier in the week, Monday, about some of the personality issues that are going on here. And let's expand on that a bit today. What do we know about how these leaders feel about each other?
If we're talking about the three key figures, the French, the German, and the Italian leaders, relations are poisonous. They all seem to detest each other. I mean, starting with Berlusconi, he's apparently seething since the other two, President Sarkozy of France and the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, cornered him and gave him a dressing down at the last summit, accusing him of failing to get his government's finances under control. Merkel and Sarkozy can barely conceal their contempt for Berlusconi when they were asked at a joint news conference whether they felt reassured after their meeting with the Italian leader. They just smirked at each other and exchanged ironic smiles.
What do we know about how Mr. Berlusconi feels, though?
Well, Berlusconi, we know what he feels about Angela Merkel. However, it is unbroadcastable. There were reports that Italian investigators wiretapped some of Berlusconi's private conversations in which he made some extremely unflattering remarks about Angela Merkel, that he didn't find her personally attractive. Yeah. One can imagine that the feeling is entirely mutual.
One can. What about Merkel and Sarkozy, though? I mean, how do they get along?
Dysfunctional seems to be the best way of describing that relationship. She is said to regard Sarkozy as two-faced. When they meet, he can smother her with Gallic charm. One witness described the performance as syrupy. But as soon as she leaves the room, he changes tack and starts running her down. She's said to be extremely hurt that Sarkozy told another leader, Merkel says she's on a diet, but when the cheese trolley comes round, she's in there like a shot and wants a second helping. So they don't get on either.
That's horrible. Is there any chance for something substantive to happen as long as these three are so key to the negotiations?
Something substantive has to come out of this. And what we're getting so far is just an outline agreement. These leaders are going to have to settle and submerge their differences and produce something. The international community demand it.
Stephen Beard in London with a little bit of insight there. Stephen, thank you.
Okay, Kai.
Greece is broke and broken. Ask a German and he'll shrug. They drink and dance during the day. We wait for sunset.
Commentator Todd Buchholz.
So the hardworking, disciplined, punch-the-clock-on-time Germans stay solvent and sober, while the Mediterranean neighbor lolls around in fertile fields of lemons and olives. So why do Germans grudgingly reach into their pockets to bail out their dancing neighbors? It's not just the economy, stupid. It's also culture. Friedrich Nietzsche and Goethe can teach us more about the Euro crisis than John Maynard Keynes. Germans have been searching for a missing part of their soul, passion. They envy the sun-filled days of their Mediterranean neighbors. Nietzsche was fascinated by ancient Greece and juxtaposed sober Apollo with that reckless, wine-drinking southerner Dionysus. A dose of Dionysus might not be so bad for Germans, he figured. Today, German companies like BMW conquer markets by manufacturing flawless motors. But when do Germans experience the fun of Dionysus? When vacationing in Greece, Italy, Spain, and Portugal. And then there's Sigmund Freud. His Germanic surname translates as joy. If only. Freud, too, thought that Italy and the South could save the Teutonic psyche. Freud poses superego and id. The id hosts ecstasy. The superego is that German librarian frau with her hair tied up in the bun telling you to shush. On the map of Germany, you can find quite a few towns called Buchholz or Buchholz. My wife once scolded me for acting too uptight, saying, "You take all the fun out of everything." Wow. I felt both powerful and bad. I could take all the fun out of everything. Even Zeus didn't have that much power. But a starchier-than-thou power sickens the soul. So today, Germany has the power and the discipline, and yet still feels pretty bad for its neighbors. And so, to maintain their own sanity, Germans are willing to write some hefty checks.
Todd Buchholz was an advisor to the first President Bush. His new book is called Rush: Why You Need and Love the Rat Race. Yeah, I don't know. Share your thoughts. Marketplace.org is the website. Coming up.
Taking water from the Yangtze and carrying it to Beijing is like diverting the Mississippi River to Washington, D.C.
What could possibly go wrong? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials charged up 162 points today, 1.3% close at 11,869. The NASDAQ picked up 12 points, just shy of 0.5%, 2650, the number you're looking for. The S&P 500 also gained 12 points, about 1%, ended things at 1,242. Another day, another internet company flashing red on trading screens. Amazon sank 12.2% one day after reporting sharply lower profits due to e-reader development costs and investments. Ford, fresh off a labor deal with the UAW, rolled out lackluster earnings and its shares fell 4.5% today. Boeing 787 Dreamliner made its first commercial flight today. The company's stock took off with it. Boeing shares rose 4.5% on profit growth and raised its annual outlook. Two rival military contractors, though, reported solid earnings and their shares fell. Lockheed Martin down 3.2%, Northrop Grumman off 1.7% on concerns of Pentagon budget cuts. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, offering business owners financial guidance for the long term. Information at massmutual.com. And by Reputation.com, helping small business owners, professionals, and executives monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation.com. Marketplace Innovation Reporting is supported by the 2012 Jaguar XJ. Learn more at a local dealer or at JaguarUSA.com. Listen to the numbers on your own time. Download the new Marketplace Radio iPhone app for on-demand access to all of our radio programs right on your iPhone. Coming soon for the Android.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department releases its Advance Estimate Gross Domestic Product Report for the third quarter. The National Association of Realtors issues its Pending Home Sales Index for September. And on October 27, 1904, New York City's first official subway system began operation in Manhattan. It ran from City Hall to 145th Street and Broadway. Passengers had to buy a ticket to ride. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
I spent the day in Athens Monday, Athens, Georgia, that is, exploring the Greek debt crisis, and at one point wondering whether the whole sad episode isn't a little bit like a Greek tragedy. Our resident classics professor, Emily Allen Hornblower from Rutgers, reminded me of the fable of the grasshopper and the ant. to her cap here for a minute. The grasshopper sings all summer. The ant stores food for the winter. The grasshopper comes begging for food and shelter when the weather turns colder. The ant says, nuh-uh. I made the case that maybe one could think of Germans as the hardworking ants, the Greeks the not-so-hardworking grasshoppers. Maria Kominou is, as you'll hear, a Greek native, now living in Farmington Hills, Michigan. She says, I got it all wrong.
Those who least can afford it, on low salaries and on small pensions, pay for the folly of the top money makers. The only myth in this story is the myth of the lazy Greek. Even the crooks in Greece are not lazy.
Robert Power of Hummelstown, Pennsylvania, figures the story ought to go a little bit more like this.
The ant worked hard all summer, collecting fruits and vegetables and patching walls in the nest, while the grasshopper played guitar and sang all summer. Winter came, and the ant died from overwork. The grasshopper liquidated the ant's estate and bought a beachfront condo in Miami, where he could play guitar and sing all year long.
Steve Presteman of Los Angeles offers an alternative with an extra character.
A snake that whispered in the ear of the grasshopper, "Go on, keep dancing. The ant will never let you starve. And if you give me a cut, I'll make sure he doesn't. In fact, why don't you dance a little longer?" If the grasshopper is Greece and the ant Germany, then of course the snake would be Goldman Sachs and the other banks. And when it all came down, the snake just slithered away, hissing an evil laugh. Perhaps all us ants should let the snake starve this winter.
Snake, ant, or grasshopper, take your pick. You can send us your thoughts, marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. All right, so the interesting tidbit from the European debt crisis negotiations today goes a little something like this. It's gotten so bad that French President Nicolas Sarkozy has been reduced to cold calling, like a bond salesman, which is, come to think of it, a pretty good description. Bloomberg News reports that Sarkozy is going to put in a call to Chinese President Hu Jintao to try to talk him into contributing to an expanded European bailout fund. China, of course, has the money because its economy is growing at 9% a year. It's growing so fast, in fact, that China is running out of water. Scientists say that Beijing and Tianjin, two cities in the north with more than 34 million people between them, are going to run dry in just a couple of decades. And the proposed solution turns out to be the biggest public works project in the world. Our Chinese correspondent Rob Schmitz has the story.
Tens of thousands of workers are constructing what is essentially a concrete river 800 miles long through central China. In 3 years, China plans to release water from one of its largest reservoirs into this new waterway. Hardly anyone's questioning whether it will get to Beijing, but China's top scientists and policymakers are debating whether diverting all this water is worth the potential damage to the environment and whether it's wise to spend $62 billion to build a project dreamed up by a dictator who died 35 years ago.
Mao Zedong's philosophy was that man can conquer nature, but if you act against nature, you will be punished.
Dai Qing is a former Communist Party member who's written books criticizing China's water policies. She says a big problem is China's Communist Party. It's always been ruled by engineers. Dai happens to be an engineer, too.
Our leaders think that this project is a simple matter of mathematics. It's much more complicated. How will it impact the environment and climate of the Yangtze River region? That's a problem that can't be solved with a calculation by engineers.
Taking water from the Yangtze and carrying it to Beijing is like diverting the Mississippi River to Washington, D.C. Some Chinese scientists warn that taking so much water could destroy the ecology of China's southern rivers. What's clear is that it's already taken a toll on the people. Ji Guimei picks peanuts at her farm in the village of Shirlin in Henan Province. 350,000 people have been forced to move from their homes for this project. She and her husband are among the last remaining holdouts.
None of my neighbors have moved either. The government wants us to pay a huge sum of money for our new home. We can't afford it, so we're staying here.
Ji says the local government has offered the equivalent of $1,000 for her old home, but has asked them to pay 16 times that for a new one. Ji admits she doesn't even know anything about the project she's moving for. Her husband, Sun Bencheng, does, though. He says if the money's right, he's willing to move for it, too, but it won't be easy for the 75-year-old farmer.
My family's lived in this village since the Ming Dynasty. We have a saying here, neither a silver nor a gold house is better than your own poor house.
The local government official in charge of this area is Xiao Yaodong.
We don't consider those villagers migrants. They're not moving as far as many others are, so we're not compensating them as much.
But in general, China is giving out more to migrants than it has for past mega projects, much more than it gave to those who moved for the first phase of this project, a huge reservoir China built in the 1950s. Author Mei Jie wrote about her family's relocation back then. She was away at college when her family had to move.
When I returned home, I couldn't find the place where I had grown up. It was underwater. I miss my hometown so much, I felt I had to tell the world about the suffering of the people in China's south so that the people in the north would cherish their water.
But northern China has been too busy growing to take notice. Now, nearly 200 million people live on the North China Plain, a place where desert gobbles up an area the size of Rhode Island each year. Back in southern Hunan, a family of pigs sleeps on top of each other in their new home. This is the new village of Jiahua, 100 miles away from where it used to be, a memory that will soon disappear underwater. The new village consists of drab cement buildings painted bright yellow. Farmer Li Jinrong used to make $5,000 a year in her old village. That's 25 times more than what she's made this year. She's dipping into her savings to afford electricity and running water, luxuries she's never had before. With a crooked smile, she recites a popular phrase written on communist propaganda posters throughout China. Shi xiao jia, wei da jia. Sacrifice the small family for the big family. Reporting from Hunan Province, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, transforming society through entrepreneurship and innovation. BattenInstitute.org. And by Putnam Investments, committed to helping families across America pursue their college savings goals. On the web at putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today in which economy watchers wax poetic. The Kauffman Foundation does a quarterly survey of economic bloggers, concentrating most of the time on policy questions. This time around, though, they asked for the state of the economy in haiku. So we picked some favorites.
Many angry folks watch political duck soup. Less soup, back to work.
No one has a job except econobloggers, and they're not paid much.
This is not so hard. Helicopter money, please, wired straight to households.
That was In Order, Economic Haikus from David Zetland, our Friday regular Felix Salmon, and Steve Waldman as well. Hat tip to The Economist magazine for finding it. You can read the full list at marketplace.org. Send us your own if you got it in you. That's all we got in us. That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media, on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow rebounded 162 points, 1.3%. The NASDAQ picked up 12 points, just shy of 0.5%. The S&P 500 also gained 12 points. That's 1% on that index. Ravi Karman, Stephen Cologne, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Same bat time, same bat channel. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.